welcome to episode 403 of Film Wax Radio. I'm your host, Adam Shartoff, coming from Brooklyn, USA. And this is one of those rare cases where I've invited someone on to join me to do an intro. I did this a few weeks ago, even though the Frank V. Ross, and we did, and then I invited him to do my intro as well. But today my guest, intro host, guest on my intro is John Hogan. Hi, John.
That is me. Hi, Adam. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Doing well.
Good. Thank you. I'm having John on, everybody, because John has been contributing to my blog, and thank God, I might add, because I've had this blog and nobody's contributed, including myself. I just don't have the time. So thank you so much for doing that, and I thought this is I should be thanking you publicly.
Okay, I accept that that thank you publicly. Yeah. That's how that works.
Yeah. There is an apology in there too, because I should have done it a while ago. But we just came out of a couple weeks ago, the new director's new films.
Yeah, great stuff there.
Very true. And you wrote a bunch of things, and they're spectacular. So people should, if they're a fan of that festival, which is a collaboration between the Film Society of Lincoln Center and the Museum of Modern Art, which has really launched a great many filmmakers. I was surprised to hear how many great filmmakers and famous filmmakers came out of that festival
on. I saw The Babadook there maybe a year before it was released in, I want to say, 2014, early 2014, something like that.
Mm-hmm. And then were you scared when you walked out of there?
I felt comforted. I was comforted by the ending, I feel like.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I think they're doing an American version of that one, too.
Are they?
I'm not sure.
Yeah. I mean, that doesn't surprise me. It's one of the things you hear, and you're like, of course people will try that. Yeah.
I don't know. It's an English-spoken film. Yeah. Why can't you just leave it as it is? But it's, of course, you know, the American way, and their Tony Erdman is being redone with
Jack Nicholson. That's crazy. Yeah.
Kristen Wiig. So it should be interesting. And if anybody's seen Tony Erdman, they know the sort of the penultimate scene in that film. And I wonder what they're going to do with Kristen.
I wonder.
I'm going to go see that if they're faithful to the original. But John, thank you for contributing to the podcast. To the blog. And you know, and I know now Tribeca Film Festival is happening, and there's other types of film events. And you know, whenever you can do it, it's so appreciated. And I hope that people will read your stuff. You know.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to getting some stuff up about Tribeca, too, because I've been seeing some great films there and want people to know about them, so looking forward to that.
Yeah, thank you. And where are you from originally?
I'm from South Jersey, right outside of Atlantic City.
Oh, you are?
In the Pine Barrens,
a town
called Galloway.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I do know a lot of family from New Jersey, so, okay. And did you go to school up here? What brought you to New York, ultimately?
I went to Fordham up in the Bronx for 4 years.
Oh, okay.
And did my grad work up in Syracuse, so I kept it in the state pretty much. But you know, when it came time to look for work,
were you studying in grad school?
Communication and rhetoric.
Oh,
so
okay.
I was teaching public speaking to undergrad business majors, which is always that's a humbling experience, let me tell you.
Oh, very good. And now journalism is your thing.
Yeah. Writing. You know, I try and write about film as much as possible. It's a passion of mine.
And where else do you contribute?
At Flagpole Magazine in Athens, Georgia, and for Hyperallergic, the New York City arts blog.
Okay. And so people can go to Hyperallergic.com. Okay.
And FlagpoleMagazine.com.
FlagpoleMagazine.com and FilmWaxRadio.com.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's blog/FilmWaxRadio.com or FilmWaxRadio.com/blog. I'm not positive, but...
Try both of those. You'll find my reviews. That's the way that works. Yeah.
Or just Google John Hogan, Film Wax.
You'll find me.
Yeah. Well, this upcoming guest today is a friend of mine, actually, Philip Shane. So back in 2011, Philip came out with a very successful documentary called Being Elmo. And that film was about the man who essentially, you know, invented the character Elmo and who provided the voice. And his name is Kevin Clash, and he's very famous. And I want to add that there was and we're going to talk about it a little bit, even though Philip shies from discussing this in a way, because I understand the sensitivity around it. But Kevin Clash was dragged over the coals subsequently after Being Elmo came out a couple of years later and accused of terrible things.
Yeah.
And I just want to say that it was turned out that he was vindicated And these were unfounded accusations, and so, but of course, you know, it still did a lot of damage to, I'm sure it was very, very, very painful.
Of course.
Not just for Kevin, but for everybody involved. And then subsequently, like I say, these accusations have been forgotten about. And, you know, whatever press then followed up is always going to be much less than the original press, because it's not tawdry, right? So it doesn't, you know. So I just want to put that out there. And so, but Philip is a great guy. And the reason I had him on is because, you know, he's a film guy through and through. And I would be running into him at this coffee shop in Brooklyn all the time. He goes in there and he works. Like, you know, he's very, very, you know, diligent and routinized, and he would go into the same coffee shop and work from there. And I kept seeing him, and finally I just went up and I said, "You're Philip, right?" You know, because I remembered, I don't forget faces. And I said, you know, I really enjoy being Elmo. In fact, at the screening I was at afterward, Philip and his co-director came, and Kevin and Elmo made a surprise appearance. So it was a fun event. I finally just said, after talking to Philip over the months, I said, "You should come on the podcast. We'll just talk film." And that's what this episode is. So it's very long. I've been doing a lot of longer podcasts lately. Mm-hmm. And this is just another example. So thank you for doing this intro with me.
Thank you for having me, Adam.
And you're invited back on anytime.
Sounds good.
Not just intros. You could do outros.
Everything's available.
Interstitial.
All the tros. Yeah.
I should mention there's another episode later this week. I've been doubling up a little bit, folks, so I'm not going to be back at the end of the show. I'm going to just let you know right now we're going to do another show towards the end of the week, and because we're just going to get – if I don't do that now, we're going to get – we're already back. I'm so backed up with stuff that I wanted to keep things going, and I do have even more stuff that's I got to get out because people are you know, waiting with bated breath to hear their voices on the interwebs. And then so I'm going to be posting a little bit more frequently this spring, I think. You'll see more episodes coming out. So we're going to get to 500 pretty fast, I think.
Yeah, very nice.
On a clip. So, again, check out John Hogan, H-O-G-A-N, his writing, and certainly on my blog and over the course for Tribeca. And I keep meaning to tell also my audience, and maybe I'll just do it now since I've been yammering on, about Radley Metzger's death, who I touched upon recently online that, and I wrote an obit, if you will, for Filmmaker Magazine. I don't know if you got a chance to see that. I don't know if you got.
Oh, is that to me? Oh, yeah. I have seen that, actually, yes.
All right, if you read it. But anyway, because Radley Metzger, who was a latter-day pornographer, and I you know, I don't mean to put him into that category because he was an incredible filmmaker who made film, you know, beautiful films and very rich films, that just happened to be erotic and kind of softcore, what they would later call softcore, but not under contemporary terms. Softcore, like they're fully realized films, you know, with characters and plot and all that, but they just also happen to have these sex scenes in them and nudity. But they later on, when the hardcore porn became a thing and became popular, Radley too had to change things because nobody would go to those other films anymore. Yeah. So he had to kind of up his game or quit. So he upped his game, but he changed his working name from Radley Metzger to Henry Paris. So that's the interesting part. But then he did a bunch of them. Perhaps the most famous of those hardcore ones, which were still, by the way, beautiful and funny and all that, was called The Opening of Misty Beethoven. But early on, he did all these other films, and they were really, you know, they're not for children, but they're not, they're still, there's a sense of innocence about them. I don't know. They're very stylized and really lovely. And maybe the most famous of those is called The Licorice Quartet. But there's also The Cat and the Canary. But there's a bunch, let's put it that way, and they're worth seeing. And some of them are, you can see on Amazon right now, they're available. So I recommend people check it out. Anyway, Radley died at the age of 88. It was sad because I was working on a documentary project about Radley with his involvement. Things ran into a bit of we ran into a hurdle and it kind of stopped. And me and my filmmaker producer partner were trying to find alternative ways of making this work out. But unfortunately, Radley died. Not to say that there isn't a project out there yet, but it's just going to be a very different one. So I wanted to mention Radley and what a great guy he was. It was terrific. Right up through a few months ago when I saw him last, he was still, you know, I was very surprised that he died, even though he was very frail in physically, but and not mentally. So that's kind of sad. Anyway, changing the tone again back now to episode 403. This is Philip Shane. He's a documentary filmmaker. He's a super guy, and we had a great time talking. And this is that conversation. Talking to Philip Shane, thank you for coming.
My pleasure.
And where we were talking about something that we're not going to talk about, which is Kevin from your film. We're just going to say, because it's still murky territory, even though he's been exonerated. That's all I'm going to say. He's been exonerated. That's important.
He's an amazing man.
So it's right. It's a documentary that you co-directed, which had the most attention, I'm going to guess, of all your work.
Yes.
Right?
Oh, yeah,
and
for sure.
I Am Elmo, as it was called, I think?
Being Elmo.
Being Elmo, excuse me, Being Elmo.
Although I like I Am Elmo.
I Am Big Bird, I think, is what I confused it with. Which was another...
He was Big Bird.
Which was probably made on the based on...
Previous generation.
On the success of... Right.
Easily, no, actually, interest, just one
they
thing.
Made it concurrent?
He, actually, even before, my understanding is that Connie knows much more about this.
So you guys piggybacked on their success.
His wife had been collecting... footage, or you know, I don't know. They've been thinking about doing a film for many, many years, and so I think they would have finished it anyway. Certainly, he's an amazing. Oh, what an amazing person he is! So I think
they've all got to be. Yeah. So I was just all those people on that show. You know, they're just
on set
such icons, and and it's odd that it felt a little bit like a betrayal when HBO. Just sort of took it over. I'm not saying it is. I'm just saying it felt emotionally to a guy who grew up on Sesame, or whose early years I was, you know, huge on Sesame Street. You know, I grew up in a lucky time. We had Sesame Street. We had the Electric Company.
Yes.
And even Zoom was kind of. I grew up in the time of what was it called again? Wonderama.
I went to see Wonderama live.
You did. You went. Now let me ask you: was it the national version of it, or was it the local show with Bob McAllister?
I was so little.
Kids
I'm not sure.
Are people too. Wackadoo, wackadoo.
But it was. I mean, in my mind, it was a gigantic auditorium. I was really little. I had to eventually. My grandfather had to take me out because I got too scared of. It was in combination with H.R. Puffin stuff.
Oh.
And that show, which I loved, that show.
Yeah, but it was really trippy
the
stuff.
The two guys who made that show.
Oh.
The Croft?
Croft. Seals and Croft? Or is that a band?
No, but
that was a band, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's embarrassing.
No, it's not Seals and Croft. But
they were a band.
The Croft Brothers or something. And, when Puffin Stuff, the real Puffin Stuff, so-called, came out on stage, I just...
freaked out.
It's too real.
Too intense.
Too intense.
For a little kid, yeah.
Yeah.
So we were just chatting about that before we started, but we can't really get onto that topic about because it's a little murky in terms of your understanding of everything, even though. All right, but the judge threw the case out. That's all we can say. And he's been.
I also want to say that in my mind and in my heart, it plays no role. It's some weird fiction that it was like this weird thing. Kevin is one of the most inspiring people to me ever. I mean, I'm trying to think. Almost every one of my films or film that I've got to work on or television show has been a biography and involves people that I'm just completely inspired by. And that was Being Elmo in particular was one of the most mind-blowingly inspiring things, partly because he's alive, very much alive.
Yeah, right.
And you get to meet him.
So,
I've worked on, I've worked on other people who I was incredibly inspired by and admire. Albert Einstein, Martin Luther King. I didn't have the fortune of meeting them.
I understand. Well, I just, getting on these scandals from past, it does, It's an understatement to say that the American culture is really loves a good scandal, you know, and we get them so frequently. We never get tired.
You know, well, it's interesting you say that because some, yes, the American public, I suppose a large proportion of...
Not just them, but...
Well, yeah, but just, yes, there's a lot of people that are interested in it, but I think I'm going to just put myself in the category of, along with a lot of other people, of not... it doesn't enrich my life in any way to follow those things. I mean, if it's a really important scandal, you know, some terrible thing, a crime, okay, it's an important story.
Right.
But I live my life by, honestly, things that inspire me, things that I can learn from. And fortunately, I don't feel I have any inclination to something that I need to learn. Oh, don't do that. Right. I sort of have it.
I guess, yeah. And in this case, you know, where... There were so many times like this where we just hear the accusations and the allegations, and then that's all we hear about, and then we don't find out about the exoneration, or there's so much less attention about the exoneration that it kind of disappears, and it doesn't fulfill that same appetite that we clearly have for the first part, which is the explosion and of the torrid sensationalist, you know. Stuff that goes on. So, but then there's the cases of, like, a Bill Cosby, who, you know, is turns out to be such a hypocrite on top of the crimes.
That's funny.
That there is this feeling of good. And, you know, I mean, some people aren't so attached to the idea about him, the hypocrisy. They're just more like, well, we've heard about these stories for years, and it's great. He was so powerful. And,
well,
and,
to be clear, I mean, I'm not saying that any of these stories are not important. Of course, they're important.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because it goes right to the core of the kind of movies I like to make and the kind of stories I've always been interested in, which is, I remember, it's so funny because I was thinking about this on the way over. When I went to NYU grad program and I was sitting at the Steam Deck, which we had back then, and I was editing my movie. And next to me was a woman in our class making her movie. Mm-hmm. Now, her movie was about race and poverty and, you know, like important stuff, an intense film about people in crisis. And my movie, farts. I confess, but I've had a journey about my feelings about this movie, was about my relationship to peanut butter and jelly. Now, don't tell me that's not important. But I felt at the time it wasn't important.
I assume you're speaking metaphorically. Peanut butter
it was a trilogy.
The haves and the jelly of the have-nots.
Right.
And...
Exactly. No, but actually, just to be less flip about it, I mean, my story, it was a personal story about me and my family and difficult upbringing and, you know, my parents who ultimately got divorced and all this kind of stuff.
Wait, this is the same
It was a story. Comedy. It was like a Woody Allen-esque comedy.
But it was a documentary?
No. Right. And it wasn't a documentary.
With the peanut butter jelly?
This is before I went into a documentary. Or officially.
Anyway. Yeah.
No, so this was like personal, silly. Yeah, very much like a Woody. I mean, I love Woody Allen, so it's
sure.
That mode. People playing my parents and then it being very comical, sort of, what do you call it? Satirical. But I felt guilty about that for a little bit. Maybe one reason why I went into documentaries in some ways, but I have never, and I'm very clear about this with everybody I talk to. I am so grateful for the people, which may be the majority of documentaries that get made, the people who are taking on issues, the people who are exposing, you know, problems, the people that are helping people directly, all that kind of stuff. I'm so glad there's people that make those films very loosely or just, you know, put a broad stroke on it. I'll just call those like activist films, or socially aware films. Of course, there's a whole nother kind of documentary, and I very much enjoy being in... doing portraits of people in the arts or science, which for me is also kind of another art form, or it's another creative activity. Both artists and scientists, I feel like people who are, you know, misunderstood. I happen to have been in both those camps. So ultimately, though, I came to feel like actually, you know, me and maybe other people who maybe even do it better, who make these kinds of films, we're also doing something important. You know, I mean, we're like,
yes,
we're telling stories. The other stories are going out into the real world. We go into people's minds and
right.
try to understand their lives. So,
sure. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I was thinking as you said that about programming, because I've done some programming of my own. And I was invited to program at the Maisel's Cinema some time ago.
Uh-huh.
And I just was like, oh, God, it's a heavy duty. Because it's not just any venue. It's the Maisel's Cinema. They're programming films of social relevance.
Yeah,
it's often like you're describing a political or social dimension to much of what they do. Not entirely,
mm-hmm.
but
right.
Partly due just to the fact that, well, you know, this is the guy that one of the guys that invented mm-hmm. documentary, but also the location of the venue is in Harlem,
mm-hmm.
and so there's a commitment to representing film that somehow speaks, I guess, to that culture and community. So when I went and I was just thinking, you know, gosh, there's just so much. What should I do? I was doing a series here in Brooklyn called Brooklyn Reconstructed, which were all these films coming out a number of years ago on the subject of gentrification, mm-hmm. land use, mm-hmm. policies.
Yep.
And I'd invite filmmakers and politicians and community activists and local religious leaders. And, you know, this was a great series. But when I went to the Maisel Cinema, I thought, well, you know, I'm not going to just try to figure out how to repeat that there. I should come up with something fresh. And what I ended up doing is something called Docularius, which is a series of showing documentaries about funny things, because I thought we need that in the world, more attention to fun. So each time I would invite a comedian to come and warm up the crowd. And then, you know, then one time I did a joke telling contest. We invited people from the audience to come up, and if they told a joke, they got a free DVD. And then we showed like the Joan Rivers documentary, and Ricky Stern came.
Yeah.
You know, we did a Q&A with her and the editor and the composer of that. You know, I just did a bunch of different. Must have done at least 6 or 7 of those events, and they're all one better than the Osho Winnebago Man. You know, just a lot of great funny documentaries, and so. That was my in the same kind of thing. I'm like, am I going to, you know, is it mean? But they love, first of all, the Maisel's folks thought that was a great idea.
Yeah.
Because it just also gives contrast. It shows we don't always have to be quite so intense. And also there is an importance to laughter. It's important. It's, you know, people, the most intense people appreciate it because it's you know, they like to laugh too, et cetera, et cetera. So I understand that kind of struggle, you know, that internal kind of struggle of wanting to be relevant and make a difference and, you know, do something very meaningful, you know. But as you worked out, you are doing something meaningful.
Yeah, I'm guessing that all, I mean, I feel like probably a lot of creative people or anyone who's out there doing something, the grass is always greener on the other side.
Sure.
You have doubts about, am I fulfilling
right.
it? Something that the world needs as much as that other person. But, I don't have any doubts about it now. And so, I mean, the filmmakers, when I was growing up, when I was much younger, I never thought of any difference between documentaries and fiction movies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I just would watch both. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of them be on TV or in school we get to see them, or you go to the library before you could watch the internet and all that stuff,
mm-hmm.
even before VHS. And so I was just like, oh yeah, sometimes it's real people and sometimes it's something else, you know, mm-hmm. fictional people, a different world.
Right. I'm in the same camp.
Yeah. But that being said, I'll just throw out one thing.
Sure.
When you were talking about the Docularius, which I love.
I'm thinking of reprising, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to bring that back.
Here's one thing I really like about it. I often do, you know, I see, like everyone in the documentary world, we want to always be looking for ways to make it more popular, just reach more people, right? Or look at why is it, if it's not as popular as other things. Why is that? I'm curious. I'm just sort of that type. I just love to look at a system and see what's good and what can be improved about it. And one of the things I've noticed is, I could be wrong, but I feel like documentary is not a genre. I don't know what you call it. Whatever we want to call it, you could say it's a huge meta-genre or something. But within documentary, we don't have any genres. We can think about some, and we can sort of on our own put things into categories. But most films, even music, too, like music, it usually is fairly clear where somebody is, even if they cross multiple genres. It's clear, okay, it's this and that. It's, you know, blues and jazz or blues and rock or something. Music and sports. Maybe you could say that. Music and sports.
Well, I think you could. Well,
but I don't think the audience thinks of it in that.
Oh, probably not so much. But we do in the world, in the film world or industry. I mean, I think about personal docs. I think about Verite or.
Right. But it comes down to audience
advocacy documentaries. You know.
Right. I'm actually talking. But just to be clear, what I'm talking about is sort of inarticulate about it. But. The audience experience. Genre totally affects the audience experience. We know this. You go to a Western or science fiction or romance, there are certain expectations, and the movie completely plays with and against that. Right?
Yeah.
And with documentary, we don't have that so much. And I think... this is one thing that's great. We can say documentaries are great because it's much more freeform. It's more challenging to watch. But that more challengingness, it's one of those things that makes it more challenging. And I think there's some aspect that it wouldn't hurt to define them a little bit more clearly. Like, I don't know that I've ever... it's probably been done before, but I don't know that I've ever heard that. Like, funny documentaries, you know? Mm-hmm. Everyone who comes to that is going to know...
Right.
Oh, this is going to be blank, you know.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it could be just a documentary like Winnebago Man, which kind of the way it's the tone and the pace of the way the editing is what makes it funny, because here at the core is a tragic figure in a way. You know, he's an angry, bitter guy who disappears and becomes a recluse, you know, up in the mountains in California, and disappears, and then he's found, and he's going blind, and you know, he's got all sorts of problems, and he's still angry and bitter. But the movie, you laugh from beginning to end. It's just so great, and the footage of his ranting and his raving, you know, when he, you know, the outtakes of these industrials that he was making for Winnebago. The Winnebago folks, you know, it's a great documentary. If you're listening and you've not seen Winnebago Man, I think you can see it right on Netflix. I'm pretty sure.
I'm sure. Yeah.
And I believe, by the way, while we're on the subject, being Elmo, you can.
Oh yes, Being Elmo. Yeah,
certainly on iTunes.
iTunes and Netflix.
And Netflix, okay.
Yeah, because it's constantly being recommended to me as something I might want to watch, as if I haven't seen.
Because you liked. Because
that's right.
There's a category. It comes
because
up,
you made.
Because you made Being Elmo. You may like Being Elmo. I love that.
Because you're a good-hearted person.
but the docularis could also encompass a concert film.
Anvil, the story.
That is another tragic story in a way. It's a Shakespearean practically about these two men who, are in this band, who. Love each other like brothers. You know, I talked about it, I'm pretty sure. Or I wrote in a review. I can't remember, but I just remember one of my favorite scenes in any documentary ever is a scene where, they've finally gotten the band back together. Anvil has gotten back together for a comeback album. And they're in the studio, and they are fighting. Right? Remember this?
Yes.
They are fighting, and one storms out. You know, the main guy who's... because one is named Rob Reiner. Remember, that's the drummer. I think that he goes off. I think he leaves. But there, you know,
he
the
turns
other guy,
into a green puddle.
Yeah, and the main guy, he's that he's a Jewish aging Canadian
with the long hair,
the rocker, and he's like, you know, this is all about. This is just because he's my brother. I love him. You know, this mean nothing, it does nothing, it doesn't mean anything else, you know. And it's like that moment, it just says, it's just the entire movie is around that moment, and it's just so powerful. But yes,
it's incredible that you said tragic, because
go ahead,
maybe I'm misremembering it, but I remember it being like hilarious and just very sweet. They didn't achieve their dream.
Those elements are there too, but my point, no, those two things can coexist, and I think that's what I'm saying. When I think of Winnebago Man, there's the reason those two, Anvil and Winnebago Man, are among my two favorites. Mm. They're up there at the top because they just, and I have, I believe, copies of both in my collection, is because they have at the core a tragic figure. Mm. You know, I mean, the guy who's, you know, and I should look it up, you know, it's a case where I didn't expect to be talking about it, but he feels like he's a failure. Maybe he's working in a kitchen in a school or something right at the beginning, and it's his dream is to get the band back to their former glory, but it's more than that. It's for him and his connection to this guy and the band that they have, the two leaders of the band. And, you know, it's just, you know, and I'm sure the documentary filmmaker just stumbled upon this, you know, and just got that moment. So see Winnebago Man and see Anvil, The Story of Anvil.
Yes.
Two incredible documentaries. Yes. And there's so many others here. And and another thing, Philip, when you're seeing those moments, to me, that's what makes, those are the best moments of any film, any time, because you're brought to tears. You're laughing, and then, you know, you just can't believe this is not Spinal Tap. And then you're, all of a sudden, there's this incredible moment of humanity that occurs.
Right. Oh. It's funny because, yes, that's exactly the word I was thinking of, is that these moments of humanity are the things that connect all movies and all, you know, great stories.
Exactly.
And that's what we get to see.
Yeah, so. Yeah. And Joan Rivers, you know, in her own way, too, I think is a tragic figure on some level. She can never quite be love herself. And you look what she goes through, you know. She's so full of, it seems.
Well, I have had the fortune
doubt to, and hate, self-hate.
Yeah, I've had the fortune to work with a number of... celebrities doesn't quite nail it, just like incredibly driven, and if I got to know them, or, you know, if we're going to make a film about them, probably they're successful people. Even I used to do I did improv comedy for a long time at the UCB Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, and there are some people there that I worked with, who would perform with or whatever, who are now successful, quite successful. You see him in movies and TV all the time. And what I remember is the drive and the hunger. Mm-hmm. I mean, not in a bad way necessarily, but it is a clear difference. I mean, I remember actually one time I was doing a show with Rob Corddry.
Mm-hmm. I love him.
Right? Hilarious.
Yeah, he's great.
And with Rob Hubel, who's also a great.
What's his name?
Rob Hubel.
Okay, I don't know.
H-U-E-B-E-L. He's... I'm trying to think. He's in movies now, and he also does a lot of comedy. You see him on TV, and he and Rob and a lot of those other people were at UCB. But anyway, I remember being on stage. I used to do – Rob Hubel and I would do this show called Filet au Film, where it was a monthly show at the UCB Theater where we would show short comedy films, some of which we made and others people sent in, and we would just show. And in between the movies – because it was a comedy theater and because it would be ridiculous, we would reenact famous movie scenes, but in like an insane, silly way. So I had the incredible fortune to be on stage with Rob Corddry, where he was playing the Scatman Crothers character from The Shining.
Okay.
And I was Danny, the little boy.
Right.
And...
Is it the scene in the storage room?
That's
in the
right.
Container? In the, is it
smells
a refrigerator?
Like burnt toast.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Some call it Shining. Yes, right. Yeah. They're sitting there together. Yeah. And Doc, Doc. You want some ice cream? Rob Corddry is playing what's that character, and I'm playing the little boy. And I have no pretense to be performing. I mean, I enjoy performing and all that, but, you know, no interest in being a star, anything like that. And he, it's almost hard to describe because I performed with a ton of people on stage and there was a very small number of them that, like, they got on stage, their face lit up, their energy, their focus, their control, and the attention that the audience, you just felt the audience just riveted to them, so that everything he said, you know, he would say it, and then bang, you get all this laughter, and then I would, you know, vicariously feel this, like, so I'm sitting up there, and I was just like, this is amazing. I mean, he was an extraordinary, is an extraordinary performer. But you were talking about Joan Rivers, but the drive thing, I mean, they just, these guys, all these ones who are successful, and even others, I suppose, who aren't, quote, successful or still coming up, they worked so damn hard.
I mean, there's no doubt that Joan Rivers, for, you know, 60 years or more,
unbelievable,
just worked every moment of every, those years.
Yeah, you know, I get to meet her too, because we did a I did a piece about her for in this film Making Trouble, which is about seven Jewish women entertainers.
Oh wow!
Over the years,
who are the others?
So we went from I'll just say this is a film that was made by the Jewish Women's Archive and a foundation, and I made it with Rachel Talbot. My friend, old friend, was the director, and they chose the people. There was Molly Picon from the Yiddish Theater, Fanny Bryce,
also I think from the
Yiddish. From that period, but
she became more
more in the 20s, and
but she also became more mainstream.
That's right. She was a Ziegfeld girl,
transcended into the mainstream. But didn't she was also a Jewish?
Yes.
Oh, I may be wrong.
Well, these were all Jewish. That
right.
Was
you said that already.
Right.
That I have to edit out.
This was a restricted community. You had to be a...
So I don't sound like a complete schmuck. I let it that out.
We had Fyvesh Finkel in this film, by the way. He's hilarious.
I remember Fyvesh. Sure. He was famous for the Yiddish theater and then went on to do Picket Fences. And
This, by the way, is a very entertaining film, Making Trouble.
Oh, I got to see it. I love that. It sounds like that's great. Yeah. So you've got, again, Molly Picon.
Molly Picon.
Fanny Bryce.
Sophie Tucker.
And
who I knew nothing about.
One of the famous Jewish women.
He talks about Molly Picon. He sort of narrates much of that. Sophie Tucker.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Huge star. Huge.
Yeah. Then we got into the modern era, and actually it was interesting because they had started this film quite a bit before me, and they had chosen those three and Gilda Radner.
Oh, great choice. I love Gilda.
And that may have been the ones they had, and then we were...
An unusual choice considering how short her career was.
Yeah.
Especially the best part of her career, because she was a true brilliant comedian, but... You know, from I'd say from the period of the National Lampoon through Saturday Night Live, and then a little bit after that.
Yes. Well, then
not
she
long
got
after
sick.
That. Yeah. But, you know, even though, because she made a, I think, even though I'm so happy she was with Gene Wilder, who was one of my favorite people on the earth, she wasn't really funny after they met. So, but
transformative.
But I mean, she was
the thing about all these women was that not just entertaining, but that they were groundbreakers.
Right.
That they, you know, made each one of them made more room for women in
Google Gilda Radner, The Animals.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm telling my audience, but you should too. I had her album, her live comedy album, and I listened to it like 1,000 times. But you can see her do it live, the Animals, which is. It goes, the animals, let's talk dirty to the animals, fuck you, Mr. Chicken, eat shit, Mr. Frog, you know, go tell a chicken, lick my dick.
Thank you. A rooster says good morning with a cock-a-doodle-doo. Good morning. A horse's neigh is just his way of saying, how are you? A lion growls, hello, and owls ask why, and where, and who. May I suggest you get undressed and show them your wazoo? Oh, the animals, let's talk dirty to the animals, fuck you. Mr. Bunny, eat shit, Mr. Bear. If they don't love it, they can shove it. Frankly, I don't care. The animals, let's talk dirty to the animals. Up yours, Mr. Hippo, piss off,
Mr. Fox, go tell a chicken, suck my dick and give him chicken pox. Dirty to the animals, from birds in the treetops to snakes in the grass, but never tell an alligator bite my. No, never tell an alligator bite my. Yes, never tell an
I'm in.
Yeah,
I'm
it's in. It's it in. Is because she starts it with
you
this
had me a
little,
chicken.
Yeah, the it starts with a little, you know, like a lot of classic song or old songs. They start with a little, what do you call it? A little opening sequence. You know,
the cold open.
Yeah. Well, there's a I don't know what it's called in the like the opposite of a coda.
That's right.
And it sounds like she's going to do this very, you know, innocent children's song, and then it becomes this really crude. It's brilliant. It's awesome. Brilliant. Anyway, you can watch it on YouTube.
Yeah.
And so
NSFW.
So who's the last one?
NSFW.
What?
NSFW. Not safe.
Not
for
safe
work.
For the workplace. Yes. Well, I think this day and age it probably is.
Okay.
Yeah. What was the last comedian? Joan Rivers.
Well, they, I was just saying those were the women, and then I actually suggested Joan Rivers, and it was interesting because the women who were
wait, well, who was the sixth one though? Was there
in the very last one? Sorry, was
Sarah Silverman?
No, it was actually Wendy Wasserstein, who died.
Okay.
Right before I came on, or while we were making the film, she
I don't even know her. Okay.
She's a playwright.
Oh she yeah. Oh, that's right.
Sisters Rosenstein.
I met her. She died of cancer. I do remember.
Yes.
Yeah. She had like she was a very yeah. She had curly hair and
yep.
Well, that was, you know, she's Jewish. It's not
that's
like
right.
That
very
hard.
Jewish.
No, but I do remember she was a very big. Yeah, she wrote some Broadway
she
shows.
She was the first woman to win a Tony.
Right
before and it was like 1980s.
This is before the Vajayjay monologues and
yeah.
You know.
I think so.
It is. Yeah, she was around before that when Wendy Wasserstein. Yeah, I do remember that.
Yeah.
But that's an interesting choice, too, because she wasn't a performer.
Right, exactly. But I just felt that the community that was going to watch this film would, I mean, not just me, but Rachel and the foundation, the people in the foundation. But it was interesting that Joan Rivers, some of the people involved first did not want her because... And it was interesting. It kind of gave me flashbacks to being a kid that I guess she made fun of a lot of Jewish things or whatever.
She probably, that's true. But I'm guessing she probably also...
So you either love that or you hate that. So,
well, and then you also...
She was harsh.
Yeah, she was. I mean, absolutely.
But the real woman... Did you ever meet the real Joan Rivers? I think, well, you see it in Ricky and Andy's film. So we got to do her, and she was living. So again, it was this time. It's like, oh, we actually get to meet the living person. And Rachel arranged for us to go to her. She performed at the Counting Room, I think it was, anyway, here in New York. And she was 70-something, and when we got there, she just treated us. She was like a little Jewish grandmother.
Sure.
And she was really little.
And she was a Jewish grandmother. Well, no,
so
I would see
sweet.
Her at a couple of... I didn't meet her, really. I just remember seeing her, you know, at a couple of, like, Lincoln Center, you know, galas and things like that. That's all. And I just would... Or, you know, I've seen her around a couple of times. And she... No, I know.
She wanted to make sure you had enough to eat.
Yeah. Well, for sure. No, clearly. She was not... In her real life, she was mellowed out quite a bit.
Yeah.
Because I have a feeling when she was, you know, going through the 80s and into the 90s, she probably was...
Well, what a life, also.
Yeah.
You know, what a life. What a life. So.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, so I've been considering reprising that. Whether I don't know if it'll be, like, say, at a DCTV or at the Videology, one of those places that where, you know, they're inviting me to occasionally program. And but I just kind of miss doing that, you know. Oh, sorry, that's Lucy snoring. She's a very loud snorer.
She prefers Holocaust films. We're talking about comedy.
Yeah, right. That's right. She would be wide awake if we were talking about... So I was at the movies tonight, and I went to a screening. And this is... I was a little bit of a pissed off about this thing that happens where, you know, there's an opportunity potentially to bring on a filmmaker or talent or, you know. And so they say, you have to see the film first. Now, I would, of course. And I ask for a link. They go, well, we don't really can't do that for this particular film. So please go see it otherwise, because we can't do the interviews without that. So then I said, I'm happy to go to see this particular film because I know that the film, I like the cast and I know the filmmaker is good. Yeah. And so I go. And then as on my way back, I'm like, I had a great time. I thought the film was really great. Very essential performance by Annette Bening, who I thought was terrific. Mm-hmm. And then I get an email back from the publicist saying, oh, well, they passed on, you know, doing it. Because I say no roundtables. They ask, well, would you be open to round? I can't do a roundtable. Can you imagine three other people from the media sitting around just waiting for me to, you know, I can't do roundtables. It's a podcast, you know. Mm-hmm. So I said no roundtables. So, but it's like, why couldn't you tell me? Like, I'm spending 4 hours.
You'll do a square
day.
Table, a diamond shaped table, but not a rhombus.
Even rhombus, parallelogram, even I'd be sure. open to, sure. and that, and no, and not many people are.
No,
a lot of corners, a lot of very sharp corners.
Yeah,
but I wonder why you know, because for me that's practically a 4 hour commitment. It takes you figure round, you know, maybe not quite, but it's like you figure round off an hour of travel time there, 2 hours there, around an hour getting back. You know, it's a little faster. It takes maybe a half hour, 35 minutes. But it's like 3-4 hours of my day. Mm-hmm. And then on the way back, you're telling me that I wouldn't have gone. Like, I don't have the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like going. I got there and I sat down. I was thrilled because the movie looks fantastic. I mean, cool. It is so beautiful. It's a lot of wide angle and just, it's really beautiful. Mike Mills is the, I may as well talk about it. I don't want to make the publicists are just doing the, I could confront them and say, you could have told me this before I left today. If you knew, when were you going to tell me? But I emailed them as I left saying, loved it. Can we set up the interviews? And then they're like, no, it's not happening. Fuck you. That comes out. But I feel it's really frustrating to me because it's like, I could have gotten another day where it wasn't quite rushing in, you know, when I had like you coming over, I could have, it's just annoying to me. So
but see, this is interesting because I am getting to hear about your side of the business.
I understand, right. When you have a film, you have to hire a publicist, and then this is what you deal with. Now, it's different, but it doesn't happen in documentaries so much. Mm-hmm. I mean, it does occasionally. Like, getting certain people is hard. You know, there's the certain filmmakers that are harder than others, but I've gotten almost all of them on, too. But
the phone doesn't ring as constant.
You can usually get most of the documentary filmmakers. Like Errol Morris might be hard.
Ooh,
Michael Moore. And Errol Morris is a new film. So I can only,
does he?
You know, hope. Yeah, there's a new one. It's about a photographer.
Apparently. Oh, I can't wait.
Yeah, it's just started on the just hit, I think, one or two festivals.
He's one of my favorites.
Oh, he's great. I like almost everything he's done. Even, you know, I like Tabloid quite a bit even.
Yeah, Tabloid. Yeah, I don't appreciate that one as much. But Thin Blue Line was one of those movies came out as I was a kid. And I guess I was in high school or something. I can't remember. Mm-hmm. But was like, oh, yeah, you can do that. It can be a documentary and it can have this awesome style.
Yeah, you really did change the whole. It's
and
like,
it helped.
What is
it,
this?
It wasn't just style for style's sake. It actually helped you understand the story.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, for sure.
And it carried off the notion of multiple perspectives.
Right.
The Rashomon.
Right. Yeah. His was such a fresh, the same way, even though they're totally opposite spectrum documentary filmmaker, but Ross McElwee, him too, who, you know, The Sherman's March, how could that have become a mainstream successful film? Yeah. But it did.
Ugh.
And it changed the way documentaries.
Yeah.
It just like now, you can do these stories, you know, and I mean.
It's interesting. I never thought about it, but in fact, that very much
around the same time too. I think
presaged or was a prelude to the age that we're in now, mm-hmm. the internet and webcams and you know what do you call them, video blogs and stuff like that. Right. That sort of as the cameras got lighter and the technology got much easier, you could be much more personal, more diary-like.
Sure. Diaries is.
Do you know? Have you interviewed? Alan.
Yes, Berliner.
Berliner.
Yeah,
he's actually somebody I got to meet when I was sort of coming up, and man, he's amazing.
Yeah.
His films are just beautiful.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, he's kind of something of a friend. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he did an hour on this podcast. I had him on a TV thing I did with First Cousin Once Removed, which is has a personal element, you know, element to it for me because my mother is dementia.
So
it definitely had a lot of impact. But yeah, Alan is great. Our sons are the same age. I was kind of trying to do a maneuver, but it's hard to peg Alan.
Yeah.
But he's a sweetheart.
Oh, he's amazing. And he comes from, like, I come through editing in a way. And he's very, you know, I actually took a class with him at Millennium many, many years ago. And
what's that?
Oh, Millennium was like, I wonder if it's still around. I mean, it was like a major avant-garde magazine and theater.
Oh.
But they also had classes. It was like next to La Mama on the Lower East Side.
Mm-hmm.
Near the Bowery and all that. But, yeah, just his whole collage. Just attention to every single frame.
What is it about the typewriter?
Yeah.
He keeps
an editor, it totally makes sense.
Yeah.
It's cutting.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like the splicer.
It's in the number
back in the days where we had the splicer.
It's like Fellini and the Wind effect.
Yeah, or David Lynch and the Wind also. Oh, yeah, that's a fun thing. That'd be a fun series. Directors and their fetishes,
right? And
motifs
and their sound design fetishes, or whatever the motifs. But yeah, Alan, the one he did about
Insomnia, Wide Awake or
Insomnia. Yeah,
I'm really forgetting.
But there's so many. One about his father and his grandfather.
Yeah, those are the ones I know the most. Cause
they're really moving.
His first,
so good.
Yeah.
It's beyond. It's more. There's something else going on beyond.
Well, also, you know what? Because we're talking about. It's interesting. This sort of documentaries that are a little bit more towards the expressionist side. More
right.
Not very. You know, I love Verite, of course. Right. That's my origins. But he uses collage. He used all kinds of different materials, and that's also something I absolutely love because that is pure cinema. Just it's just all this, you know, visual stuff, and yet it comes from the real world. I mean, I think even his very first film was he actually literally found a box of footage, like the movie might even be called Found Footage or something.
Oh, really?
And he edited it into like a whole story about a family and this and that. But it was a box, you know, he found it in a thrift store or something like that.
That's fantastic. So, yeah.
Alan, if you're out there, I'm sure we're getting this entirely wrong, but
hey, have you been to a studio?
No.
Yeah, it's really great. He's collected a lot of stuff, and he's a meticulous organizer of his stuff. Yeah. So if you go, he has one, and then he also has a couple of things. Like when you go in, there's this cabinet of all these drawers, little drawers, and if you open them up, they all make different sounds.
Right. He also builds art installations and stuff.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. He's an awesome guy. Yeah. In fact, when I met him, as you know him, this is funny. So I was an intern. I was in NYU at the time, and, you know, in the program, you get to intern. So I started interning in my second year there at a place called the Center for Documentary Film, I think it was. And anyway, they were making all kinds of documentaries. In fact, that's where I met Annie and Ricky. They were there at that time. Anyway, I'm trying to remember who the head producer who I worked with, Molly. I remember just coming in one day and saying, it must have been Molly Thompson. I think so. I just saw the most amazing movie on PBS last night. It was Intimate Stranger.
Oh, okay. Alan's film.
Right, about his father. And she says, you know, the filmmaker is here. Do you want to meet him? I was like, what? You got to be kidding me. So then she called him into the room, and he comes in, and I said, I just saw the most amazing movie. And he said, he mentioned this, the movie that was on TV after that, whatever it was. He's like, oh, I know. Wasn't that a wonderful film?
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, wait. No, I don't know. I didn't even see it.
Your film, you knucklehead. Yeah. Yeah, he's a great filmmaker.
Well, here's an interesting question for you, because how universal is this feeling? There are certain movies and other works of art or whatever, but let's talk about movies, that you instantly feel like a total personal connection to this thing. And Alan's films were like that. And fortunately, I've actually now over the years, one of the things I love most about documentaries, especially if it's one I'm going to make or whatever, or one I'm going to jump aboard, you get to meet people you'd love to meet. It's sort of an excuse to get to, sure. to meet them. And I have met people, for instance, I'm working on a film now that I'm making about the brothers Robin and Rand Miller, who made one of the most popular and important video games of all time. It was called Myst.
Mm-hmm. I remember that. Sure.
Yeah. Was like the most popular game for more than 10 years. Mm-hmm. Pushed the technology forward. These were two guys who they literally made the game in living in like a mobile home in Spokane, outside of, in the woods outside Spokane, Washington or something. Anyway, absolutely loved this game. Just like, I mean, it is so meaningful to me my entire life. I think about it constantly. Whenever I see things, I'm like, oh, that's so missed, you know, something that looks like something out of the game. To this day, 30 years later, I got to meet them. They came and they spoke here in Brooklyn this summer. And I went and I got up the nerve to go meet them because I'm actually incredibly shy. Yes. Gravitate towards editing art. I met them and I come, you know, now I've gotten to know them and I've,
yeah, that's neat.
I'm just like, oh,
That is, I
we are very similar in many ways.
Oh, I see. Yeah. And it's also when there are these people that are your heroes and then you, years later, meet them.
Yeah.
They're in part, so had such impact on your formative years and then you meet them later on and you get to know them personally. It's an odd thing because, you know, in one case, I interviewed Volker Schlondorf, and this was like 2 years ago.
Cool.
And when I was a young guy, and I was just kind of, you know, starting to see cinema on my own, and, you know, The Tin Drum came out, and I saw it. I went to the movie theater two or three times to see it, because it was just, I just loved it, and was so, like, you know, blown away by it. And then, like, you know, 25 years later... Or longer, 30 years later, there I am sitting in a room, you know, with Volker Schlondorf. And I'm like, I can start the interview and I can say, I got to tell you that you made, The Tin Drum really had a profound effect on me. And I just want you to know. And, you know, it was a great moment. He was very, you know, I think tickled by it. And he said, well, you should go and purchase a copy. It's on the Criterion Collection.
I'm sure you stole it off BitTorrent.
No. He goes, no, actually, he says, we can go to a clip from it. But he said, you know, I'll maybe if I can remember, I'll write Peter at Criterion to get you a copy. But I had a copy, but it wasn't the Criterion copy. Sure. So I think I'm sure he signed it since Beautiful. I brought it. So I think I, you know, it was some other version of the Tin Drum before it went to the Criterion Collection.
Sweet.
I'm pretty sure. But you know, just to meet people, you know, even as a in America, as obscure as Volker Schlondorf, again in America. But you know, those people that have made these things that had such a profound effect.
Well, it's nice. It's nice when like him. You're saying he
right is so
very still nice. Very much appreciated.
Like, well, yeah, because I don't think he gets that too frequently.
Yeah, at this conference, it was a video game conference here called Killscreen, and which is like a magazine and a organization that celebrates culture, sees culture through video games and stuff like that. And it's very much like the indie. It's interesting. It's sort of like. It's not a festival like Sundance or something, but it's sort of like it's like a Sundance type thing for video games. It's all about the indie culture. It was like fascinating. I only went because I wanted to see these two guys who I'd wanted to see for 30 years.
Robin and Rand.
And when they spoke, and first when I got to meet them, and then when they spoke, you just this you know they're still artists. They're still one of the brothers continues more as a composer and a filmmaker. And the other has continued with the video games, but just so appreciative, just downright That's appreciative, nice. As I feel like they are. They seem as much as they would have been back then.
Yeah,
you know, it's interesting. Yeah,
well, I've been very lucky to bring on quite a few people that, you know, if not childhood, probably, but from my young adulthood when, you know, I was really like having the, like Hal Hartley going to his apartment and doing an hour with Hal Hartley. Going, you know, sitting with people like that who just, you know, people like that or, just amazing. There's a lot of examples, I guess, of that, you know, doing this thing. It gives me the opportunity to reach out.
Yeah.
You know, and now I have the bona fides to sort of not maybe get Mike Mills on, but or Greta Gerwig back on, but who, by the way, is sensational. She can be very. She can. I love Frances Ha and a few other films. Greta Gerwig, but I find that she's become a little mannered in this kind of ditzy thing she does, and that she leans back on. I think possibly.
Yeah.
But in this one, she doesn't, and it's a very different performance. And her look is strikingly, she looks very different in this film, too. Mm. But she's really good.
Mm.
Cool. It's a really, just, it's called 20th Century Women. Mm. And I'm going to still plug it, even though I have a problem with the way that things went down. Like, you know, Mike, you know, come on. You know you're going to do the podcast. Bring Miranda with you.
This is, like, their subtweet. I think you just did, like, sub-podcast.
I don't know if anybody's listening to that. It matters. But, you know, my big get has been, and is, I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon, is Jim Jarmusch, too, because he's another guy, you know, who I really
He's a Brooklyn, right?
I don't know.
Maybe not.
What?
He's a Brooklyn-based person.
No, he's an East Village-based guy.
Oh, excuse me.
He's always been in the East Village. I see. That's I mean, that's how I...
You're right. It goes back to when the East Village was like Brooklyn.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, but I've had on everybody else from Stranger Than Paradise, just about. Wow. I mean, John Lurie and I Skyped.
Very cool.
But I had on Richard Edson, who was, you know, and Esther Balint. And I had on, I've become friends with Tom DiCello, who shot the movie.
Yeah.
So it's like that kind of thing.
Coffee, you know? And Cigarettes, I love.
Oh, yeah.
I love that movie.
Yeah.
And Stranger Than Paradise, too, of course. But, it's funny, in this vein, I started out in science, and had actually worked in NASA when I was much younger, and was pursuing a career in...
Outer space?
Outer space, yes. There's a lot of room. It's a growth opportunity.
Yes.
You have to bring some oxygen, but other than that, you're okay. So I just love... I've grown up with scientists. I have a part of me which is of that type, you know, just a fascination with science. And frankly, when it comes down to it, it's just, I just love obsessive nerds, geeks, as we now more generously call it. A few times I've gotten to work on, and I hope to do many more, but science-related documentaries. And one in particular, I got to do it was just one of the best opportunities I've ever had to do this documentary about Albert Einstein for the History Channel, 90-minute documentary. And my friends Kenny Druckerman and Banks Tarver. Oh, she's snoring.
She's so loud that I have to.
We're going to pause for a moment. And
Hey, don't rip. Lucy! She's so slow. That didn't even wake her up or phase her. Or the cat, I might add.
Technical difficulties.
Lucy!
Oh, and Ken Druckerman and Banks Tarver, who run a fabulous company. Do you know Ken?
No, I know.
Yeah, they have Left Right Productions, and they do like an enormous amount of programs. They actually do a lot of Frontlines. They also do a lot of reality TV and everything in between.
Mm-hmm.
But I know Kenny from Maisels. We both worked at Maisels.
Oh, okay.
Started at Maisels together. And I got to make this Einstein program with them. And because I feel like one niche I love exploring or just diving into is like the ability to talk comfortably to very awkward, very, you know, this, that, what, the super nerd,
socially
obsessed, yeah, socially
awkward,
right. Especially people who don't normally go into media of any kind. But you know, people, myself included, are just fascinated with what they do. And I feel like Errol Morris is in this vein too.
He invented the Interatron, or was it
that's called? Right. Yeah, the Interatron.
The Interatron.
Yeah. Interesting you say that, because we actually used Kenny build his own Interatron. Very, very simple device. Just getting to sit with them, and once, you know, they see you, you actually appreciate what they're talking about. It doesn't have to be incredibly deep, but it's a genuine interest.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably the key to getting people really comfortable. You're genuinely interested in what they're saying. That is just the greatest joy for me, because having left science in particular, I always felt, I'd left that important, going back to talking about important careers, whatever. And I feel like, well, with documentary is one way of giving back to for me, for science, if I can do that, that's great. Helping them communicate incredibly difficult things, but the things that are just amazing that people should know about what humanity has achieved, positive things or not so much. For me, the difference between doing those kind of films about scientists versus artists, it's a similar kind of thing. It's just mm-hmm. like getting into what it's like to be that person doing that process. Mm-hmm. That's my favorite thing.
You should do a podcast interviewing scientists.
I've thought about this many times. Like I have. This is in the. I'm maybe like you. I love radio, and since I was a kid, I actually made radio. Made my own radio shows when I was a kid.
Oh, sure. I had a tape recorder.
Yeah, I had a tape. One of my first formative moments was probably when I was 8 or something. I used to watch In Search Of, early Leonard documentaries with Leonard Nimoy's
whose
voice.
Son was on this podcast.
Oh, right, Adam. Mm-hmm. I can't wait to see that film.
Yeah, it was quite good. But anyway.
Yeah.
And Adam came to the studio and did my podcast.
I saw that. Listened to that. That's great.
Oh, you listened to it, or are you going?
Not. It's on my. It's in my, okay. Right here. It's on my phone.
Sure.
In Outcast. What was I going to say?
Oh yes, you're.
So right, oh so and I loved reporters for some reason and stuff like that. So I asked for a birthday gift, and I guess my parents got me one of those old cassette recorders, and great. So then I started making things, my own shows with that, and then I discovered that I could connect it to the train, the transformer that you use with your model train set, which is just I think they call it a rheostat, maybe. It's a device that has a dial, and it just has two wires that come out and connect to the tracks. And the way it makes a train go faster or slower is it just pumps more juice, I think, into the tracks, right? So I discovered that if you take those two wires off the tracks and instead connect it to the battery terminals in your cassette recorder, you can speed up and slow down the tape. So then I could do all these different voices and sound effects and stuff like that by changing the speed. Then I thought, you can make the train go backwards.
How do you do that?
Well, just turn the dial all the way to the left. So in the middle of the dial is zero. Mm-hmm. Doesn't go anywhere.
Sort of negative, in other words. Huh? Like the negative.
That's right. So when you turn it to the right, the train goes forward faster and faster and faster and faster.
Yes.
Turn it to the left. In the middle, it goes to zero. And then keep going to the left, and now you go backwards. So
you can actually.
I could like do.
Yeah.
Turn me on, dead man. Turn me on.
Paul is dead.
Beatles. Right. Exactly.
Yes.
So I did that, and the tape didn't move, and smoke came out of the.
Right. It makes sense. Yeah. It's theoretical.
Yeah. So later, I moved up to reel to reel tapes.
Oh, I see.
But I love audio. In fact, this is totally crazy. Now we're getting into the deep. I don't know if you've ever done this. I can't be the only one, but I'm the only one I know of who throughout my life, you become afraid of like something happening to you. Like, what if I lose my arms?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd be like, okay, well, this is what I'd do. And always, what if I go blind, for instance, mm-hmm. And I thought, I'll do radio. And there was a blind radio announcer when I grew up in Washington.
Oh, no.
He had a show called The Big Broadcast, and he would play all the old radio shows. And it turned out he was blind. If you saw, eventually he was on television, you could see him. He was blind, and he would read his scripts from Braille and stuff like that.
So, and he would play, his thing was he would play old vintage radio shows?
Yeah, like, the dramas.
Plays, radio plays?
Yes. I would just addicted. Yeah. I would watch listen to these all night.
Do you know who's still making those?
Oh, yes, there's a few podcasts.
Oh, there are. Like that. Yeah. That's true. That's true. But Larry Fessenden, who's been on this a few times, he does a whole series. They're usually horror-ish. Yeah. They're called Tales from Beyond the Pale.
Oh, yeah.
Have you heard of that?
I know that. Okay, I know that. Yeah. And there's another one that... actually, there was, for whatever reason, just one came to mind where they were rebroadcasting old shows from the 50s, but it was all science fiction shows.
That's great, yeah.
Heinlein stories. And
oh, wonderful.
All this, I just love it. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was, the radio show was like so meaningful to me. It was just the craft of that.
I have to listen, find that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's
must amazing. Be on YouTube.
Yeah, actually, you can get it on iTunes. I mean, you can buy it on iTunes.
Yeah.
And,
okay.
In fact, now you can get a book, which is all the scripts, the original radio scripts, which is very cool. And at that time when I was growing up, NPR did a couple of long radio series that were pretty cool. They actually did one on Star Wars, like a sort of slightly different version or something. They did The Odyssey.
Really?
Which was amazing. And that actually started me getting fascinated with Greek mythology.
Yeah.
And then that's actually the hero's journey, you know, and all that stuff.
Sure.
When I eventually learned screenwriting, and to me that's one of the cores also when I make my films now.
Yeah. Right.
You know, it's so powerful. So.
Yeah, yeah. Sure.
Writing mythology. Is the whole thing. Now I have a question for you, because I maybe like I keep saying maybe like others. Because I kind of live in a box. Mm-hmm. You know, we all work in our certain way, and we don't necessarily talk to others about how they do theirs.
You especially.
Me especially. I mean, I literally live in a box. It's a Faraday cage.
I ran into you
at
a coffee shop, in Williamsburg. But
that's me being social. That's me actually realizing.
You force yourself to be out there.
Yeah.
Even though you have your headphones on and you're, you know, face deep in the big money. You're in
my cappuccino.
In your cappuccino and your Max screen. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you were going to say you had a question.
I am very curious. I at a certain point, actually with that Einstein program, I really started to apply. I've spent years studying writing and screenwriting just because I love it. This is another system. It's like, oh, this is cool. And I was like, I was always curious. I mean, when I started working, I worked with some of the great editors and documentary that are living, Bob Eisenhart, Jeff Bartz, these guys, my mentors, and through Maisels and now elsewhere, and Barbara, they work with Barbara Koppel a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I remember asking them, you know, how do you structure, you know, when you begin to put the film together, how do you know, like, what do you use? And I think most of them did it instinctually. None of them said anything like, oh, well, I used to study writing or whatever. So fine, fair enough. But I had studied writing, and I was like, can I apply that? Can I actually sort of write the film, but it's still totally true to the, still uses one of the most important things I learned through making Faraday films at Maisels, which was let the footage speak to you, you know, let the film tell itself. And I found it tremendously powerful. And actually, one of the reasons I think that being Elmo, not just the subject itself, people are, you know, it's incredibly emotional, their childhood and all these things. But it had, like, this crazy emotional power. People would come up to us just bawling their eyes out.
Really?
Men and women, thousands upon thousands, every single time we screamed. And, we can't take 100% credit for that at all in terms of making the film. But I really believe, I did that right after I did the Einstein program, and I went even further in sort of crafting it using writing skills or whatever. I think that brought out this power in the story that might not have been there otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of intense. So I do that a lot. And I was at an editor's conference at it was a Sundance thing, and I raised my hand and asked the sort of more veteran editors up there if they ever did. And one of them spoke back. He was actually irritated by that question. You know, like. Well, what I don't need to do that, and that's the great thing about documentary. We don't. It's much more free. And, you know, I totally understood everything he was saying, but also I know from having been a writing student and studied I've been to Robert McKee's seminars.
Me too.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it is.
And I also teach now, and you know that everything he was saying was the kind of thing people who are just starting out or who don't want to start out say.
Mm-hmm.
I have just found it to be like it unlocked. Mm-hmm. In emotional power in films that I know. Did you write screenwriting when you went? When did you go to McKee?
I was married. Must have been in mid 2000s.
Was it at the DGA Theater?
Yeah,
I went there too. I mean, maybe he's done multiple ones.
Yeah, he did it multiple years. But
and was it what you a 3 day?
Well, I missed the last day because of childcare, so it had to be like 2000. And I'm thinking. Jacob was born in 2004.
You know,
so
when
I
went
2005
soon
or 2000,
after adaptation.
2000. Oh no. Oh yeah, me too.
Because that's how I heard.
Right. And well, you know, right, because his character was Brian Cox played his.
Yes.
Amazingly. Yes, yeah. Incredible performance. No, I it was actually after Jake. I just lost my job at Sony Music, and so it had to have been, I think, 2006 or 2007. I'm thinking it was 2006. That's when I think I went to the.
Oh yeah, so I was there before that. But anyway.
But well, yeah. So I missed the last day, and then I made it up the next time he came in. They allowed me to come back and just sit in the last day because, you know, he does this whole thing on the Casablanca.
That's right. The last day is just Casablanca.
Yeah.
Frame by frame. Frame by frame.
Beat by beat, I should say. Not frame by frame. That would be
Right.
Beat by beat.
Right. Although at NYU, that's I went to cinema studies, and that's where we learned to do, you know.
Yeah.
You can get down to frame by frame level. I love that. I used to do that as a kid. One of my closest friends. Randy Woods, his father was an entertainment lawyer in Washington, D.C., very prominent one, and got one of the very first VHS players. You know, this enormous machine.
Yeah.
You know, for some reason, the tape had to go in like a foot above the machine, and then it went right. It was like a levered.
Wow.
The case that it went in, and then.
Yeah, sure.
And whenever you hit pause, the whole picture just went black. Anyway.
And there were people inside who received it on the inside, yeah. Took it to the lab.
That's right.
In their white coats.
That's right. That's right.
Took the tape out of the casing.
That's right.
You know, right. That'd be a sterile environment inside of this machine.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. That's why they didn't.
Yeah. It was harder to mass market those.
Tape machines, the machines we use to watch movies now are so dirty. It's just not like the old days, but all the whirring of gears. Anyway, so he got this. So he used to get these movies we could watch on tape, which was like an unheard of thing.
Right.
And they were off. It was two cassettes per movie, right? They were giant, like U-matic. Actually, it was 3/4 inch, I think, tapes. Anyway, so we got like Star Wars once, and both he and I just sat there, and we really have gone through it multiple times, frame by frame.
Really?
Oh, it's incredible the things you see actually about the. Because Star Wars, there's a lot of special effects, which sort of like, right. If you ever go through animation frame by frame, like we went through, I don't know, I guess it wasn't Roger Rabbit, but some animated films you see incredible.
Fritz the Cat, you can be honest.
Fritz the Cat, I'm not. and The Shining and Star Wars in particular, we went through frame by frame. So, but McKee, stop me if I'm rambling, but I saw adaptation. Said, oh, this guy, there's this Robert McKee thing, whatever, what is that? So I went and got his gigantic book, Story.
Mm-hmm.
And this is before I knew I was going to ever see him. I didn't even know he did that. This is how I like to learn things. It goes back to when I was in science and stuff. I just read something over and over again until I know, before I turn the next page, what's on the next page.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I went through Story like 10 times. And then eventually he gave that seminar, and so I went, and it was interesting because it really is, I can attest, it's almost literally just straight through the book.
Oh, really? And he's like, but just obsesses over the same like half dozen films.
Yes, and literally word for word.
Like, yeah. Oh, okay. Because there's like six. Right, we're in there. Like, there's like a half a dozen films that he keeps going back to.
Mm-hmm.
You
mm-hmm.
know, mm-hmm. like Chinatown.
That's right. Absolutely, Chinatown. Hearing him was really cool, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, that really is awesome. It was the heart behind all the things that he teaches and stuff. I recommend that to anybody, whether they're studying.
Is he still doing it?
Yeah, I think he is.
Mm-hmm.
But I then went on to study. I've studied all the different, well, I don't know if I've hit every single one, but a tremendous number of the writers. I don't know, Sid Field even still alive?
Yeah, Sid, I don't know, but
right.
Yeah.
But Sid Field, there are a number of people like that
in
the McKee, the sort of writing gurus.
Right.
Watch them all. Actually, now with lynda.com, you can also see a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. Read all those books. Watch those guys. It's tremendous what you can learn,
mm-hmm.
even just as a viewer.
Sure.
You know?
Oh, yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah. You don't have to be all
those more
types.
So for a viewer, almost. Yeah.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
This has been great.
Yes.
I love this.
This was terrific.
Very nice.
And, you know, I was if it had kept going in this manner, I was going to think maybe I should break it into two parts almost, but because it's, you know,
I'm game.
But well, we can do a part. We can certainly get back together.
Yes,
that's not even a question. I'm happy to do it.
Yes.
I mean, other than I know, it sounds like you're working on stuff, but I don't know if there's anything you wanted to plug or anything.
Well, yeah, actually. Mm-hmm. I am finishing trying to – I should be there right now finishing it. I've taken a momentary breather to come out to your place. But I've been working with this great young filmmaker, director, cinematographer, Kyle Kelly, mm-hmm. On this film called Train Keeps a Rolling, which is about this incredible guitar player named Jeff Golub, G-O-L-U-B. He has since passed away, unfortunately, but played with Rod Stewart for many years, was his lead, one of his lead guitarists, and played with Billy Squire before that, was like a really, like in the guitar world, especially in people who love the Stratocaster and mm-hmm. electric guitar, he was like, he's really famous. He then also had a career in jazz and blues. Amazing guy. But this film is, what happened was he went blind just out of the blue, mm-hmm. which we learned can happen. His optic nerve collapsed. And Kyle...
It wasn't gradual, but it just sort of...
Yeah, it was pretty fast in one eye, and then there's a 10% chance that it might happen in your other eye, and I think it was a few weeks or a few months later, the other eye went as well. So Kyle had heard about this story and said, hey, there's a film. So he started making a documentary.
Interesting.
It was actually kind of a lighthearted film in a way. Jeff is a very sweet, mm-hmm. funny guy. Has two lovely sons and a beautiful wife.
And he was alive when you started?
Very much alive and, like, totally fine.
How old? He's 70?
He was, I think at that point he was 54.
What?
Yes, it's a sad story.
He must have been very young.
Well, as they were filming, you know, Kyle set out to make a short portrait of this blind musician,
right.
who was adapting and with wonderful joie de vivre, like, yeah, I'm blind, but you know what? Thank God.
Sure.
I'm a musician.
Exactly. He doesn't need his eyes at that point.
He even told a story how one of his sons said to him, Daddy, you play with your eyes closed anyway.
That's funny.
It was that. But sadly, as Kyle was filming over the course of a year or two, Jeff started to change, and it became clear that he had some kind of mysterious neurological degenerative condition. Wasn't an Alzheimer's type thing. It didn't, you know, he knew where he was. His thinking was there, but it got very, very slow. Oh, and in the muscles starts a little bit more in the Parkinson's zone.
Yeah.
But they didn't know what it was.
Right.
And that becomes an incredible part of the story. So it's an amazing film. It's sad, but it's like so many stories like that. It's so full of just compassion and life. It becomes a story of his very close music community, some famous, some not. His wife's, it's very much his wife's story too, and she's still around. So the story of the caregivers, it's just this wonderful combination of a man, a rock star man, celebrating his, and we very much go into his life, and
right.
wonderful, hilarious stories, and he was such a sweet, generous guy. And the story of, you know, how does a family adapt to a situation like that? Eventually, just before he died, unfortunately, they did kind of finally give a diagnosis, and they said it was this disease called PSP, progressive supranuclear palsy, and very generously, a foundation that works with that disease had given Kyle a grant to help us get started a while back. Anyway, we're finishing that. You know, we'll be end of this year, early next, and so we'll get on the festival circuit, hopefully.
Yeah.
But it's getting out there, and it's an interesting film. It's all about creativity, and it's all about just humanity. Mm-hmm. I have another short film that'll also be in festivals, I'm hoping, this coming year, called Rewalk. It's about these paralyzed veterans that mm-hmm. I was following up in the Bronx with veteran filmmaker Michael Lesser.
Oh, yeah.
You know Mike? He was a cinematographer.
Yeah, I definitely know his name. I have to look up.
Actually, going way back, he did with Barbara Koppel a film called Winter Soldier.
Oh, yeah, I did see that. Yeah. It was not one of her greatest films.
But it's about a group of veterans.
Right, I think it sort of came together very quickly. Okay. Or something. It was about them.
Yeah, I did watch it.
Yeah.
In preparation for my long conversation with her on this podcast. Yeah. Episode number 200.
Yeah.
That I can remember.
Check that out.
Listen to episode 200 of Film Lies Radio for my hour plus long conversation with Barbara Goffel. Yeah.
Yeah.
We should do that.
Do that. Well, you should. She's
But no, Mike Lesser, yeah, for sure.
So we went up to the Bronx and over a period of time filmed three veterans, mostly older actually, different generations, learning how to walk again. So one of them's been paralyzed 25 years, another one like 12 years, and another one paralyzed only 2 years. Mm. But there are these new robotic legs, robotic exoskeletons that you can wear. And one of the very best and one of the first is this one called ReWalk. Invented by an incredible man who's actually a quadriplegic in Israel.
Well, then why isn't there a documentary about that guy?
Yeah, there should be. That'd be nice to do next. Anyway, so we followed them training, learning to walk with these things. It's not easy.
Right.
But it's way more emotional than I expected.
I wonder if they use that in the Marathon documentary, which is Annie and Ricky's new film.
I wonder because...
I think a couple of people... Well, there was one... there was this mother... one of the families that they follow, the daughter gets... It sounds like that type of...
So she has her legs.
I think she lost her legs.
Right. So the difference is that...
I'm misspeaking.
Right. It's much more common to see... because if she was in the Boston Marathon bombing, maybe lost her legs.
Yes.
So that's more, we're more used to seeing that, people who lost limbs, and they now have a prosthetic that's very sophisticated. And these are people who have their legs, which is really interesting.
Oh, okay.
And I've learned all this stuff about being paraplegic, that there's all these incredible challenges because you still have your legs, and yet they say, you know, you don't want to get rid of them because they actually provide a lot of... they take care of you a lot, even when you can't feel with them. So, but there's tremendous medical challenges of being paraplegic. And so they learn to stand again and to walk. And we followed them up until they did a race in Riverside Park. Kind of a fast walking race for them.
These are people that were paraplegic and couldn't even walk.
That's right.
And they're...
And you see quite a few of them from all over the world. There's the three we followed who are American vets. But then there's some others from around the world.
Is there any doubt in your mind that within a generation or two?
Oh, I think much faster than that. I think 5 years. I mean, these things are out now.
Right.
So they're out now.
But they're at a level where somebody who's...
You can do it. Anybody can do it.
They can't be quadriplegic necessarily. There has to be a level, like a certain...
They're
level
working on that too. But yeah, that's a much bigger challenge.
This is a certain level of what part of the spine, I guess, is... Right.
Right. Like, well, they... Okay, you're... so they do use their arms for balance.
Right.
They actually have crutches. They're not...
Yes. No, I figured that.
It's just sort of... They actually can do it without crutches, but it's there sort of as a safety thing, and they can walk with it. Anyway, it's amazing, and I could go on and on about it. Gosh, it's a short doc, but
bionic.
Bionic. But you get they have both legs, not just one.
Right.
Lastly, I'll just mention the Mist documentary is very dear to my heart, and the Miller brothers are wonderful, as is everyone that works with them to this day. We filmed them releasing their new film, new game called Abduction. You should check it out. But we'll be doing a Kickstarter for that film, hopefully maybe early next year or in the spring.
Well, let me know.
And I think that's going to be really, there's a huge community, obviously, that is interested in that. And it's not just the story of the game. It paralleled and was even a part of the computer revolution, which I grew up into. Mm-hmm. So it's that story too.
Sure.
These are two guys who lived in the woods, making this game, had no connection to anything. Next thing they know, they're in Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. They meet Steve Jobs. Their game is one of the most important things for helping the Mac become popular, and on and on and on.
Wow, it's a terrific story.
Yeah.
We live in amazing times.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's been a great, great experience. I love it. Yeah, it really, it's really gratifying. And I absolutely will do it again when, you know, your projects are you know, something people can actually see, and because it'll be, you know, it'll be a nice opportunity to get the word out.
Yeah. I'll say, was there one last thing just to the audience?
I don't know. I'm just guessing,
you know, I don't even know how much.
And then tell people how to reach you, too, or how to find
you. Oh, yeah. Oh, you can find me. I have a website. Mm-hmm. Philip Shane is with one L. That's all my parents could afford. That's an old joke. P-H-I-L-I-P-S-H-A-N-E. Shane like the cowboy, if you know that, .com.
Alan Ladd, I think.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And there's a contact page there. You can email me, and you can also see some of my films there or clips from others. Anyway, different things. But I also teach and all that stuff. I'll just say that if anyone's interested in helping. I just love helping people do this thing because this, as you know, it's hard to do some of these things, but it's not as hard as you think. Mm-hmm. If you have an interest, and I do everywhere I go, I try to say at the end, whether it's a festival or talking to you on a podcast or something, if you are interested in something and there's a story or there's something happening or just a person you appreciate that's near you. I used to say back when we had DV cameras, the technology is there. I mean, now the technology is in your pocket.
Sure.
It's unbelievable.
Right.
4K camera in your pocket.
Right.
You should go for it. Just start filming. But learn a little bit about storytelling and a little bit about editing, and you will just leap forward. But capture that thing, because that's the miracle of this age.
No small. There are lots of incredible. There's a lot of incredible information about editing and story structure that you can't even believe. Like that will just create connections in your mind and in the way you think that you could not imagine. Yeah. So it is true.
And editors, I will say, are among the most generous people in wanting to share things like that. So
thank you again. I mean, so we'll do it again.
Awesome.
All right, thanks, Phil. One L.
This is the song, la 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 la, Elmo's song. La 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 la, la 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 la, Elmo's song.
I like it.
La la la, la 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 la.
To think he wrote this alone.
La la la, la 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 la.
Catchy.
He loves to sing, la 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 la, Elmo's song.
Oh, sing it.
La 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 la, la 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 la, Elmo's song. He wrote the music.
Wow, that's great!
Yeah, I wish I had a song.